Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. It's the first week of the new year, and there may be many who are happy to see the previous year go, including friends and family of Sinze Reed, who was shot and killed in Columbus on the west side back in October. We don't really know much about what happened. The police reports offer a stereotypically sparse sketch of the details. We do know that Sinze was shot multiple times and that at least one of the wounds is alleged to have been in his back. We know that the shooter is 36-year-old white male Craig Butler, who had a previous charge of domestic violence, a conviction in fact, yet who, thanks to Ohio's overly permissive gun laws, is still allowed to carry a gun, though federal laws prohibit it. According to unnamed witnesses referenced in Columbus police reports, Butler was driving his pickup and then stopped, fired upon Reed, then drove off and returned and fired again before fleeing finally in his truck. Witnesses were able to identify Butler, which suggests that he was known in the neighborhood. He was arrested and initially charged with murder, but then those charges were dropped a few days later. Police say that Butler claimed self-defense, though on that basis, we don't know. On what basis, we don't know. The prosecutor, Gary Tyak, has said that the self-defense claim by Butler was the cause for dropping the charges, but that the case is still under investigation and may soon be referred to a grand jury if the details from the Columbus Police Investigation Report, which has yet to be released, warrant it in the eyes of the prosecutor. Friends and family of Sinze Reed have staged several protests, including one today at the prosecutor's office, and there'll be another rally at the Statehouse this Saturday. Recent history with regard to Columbus police investigations may offer little in the way of confidence, given the lack of resolution and the murder of Casey Goodson Jr. just over a year ago. His killer, former Franklin County Sheriff's Deputy Jason Meade, has yet to be prosecuted. You may recall that two neighbors of mine were murdered just a couple of weeks ago in the basement of a house just behind mine, and that case was relegated to the cold case files in just 7 days, with no details being released to the public. So there are multiple issues here. One is the police proficiency in investigating homicides. We may not know enough in each case to reasonably judge whether the police investigations are thorough and timely. But that leads us naturally to raise the question. When police statements, public statements, don't give us enough information to settle our rational concerns, it has the effect of eroding public confidence. When the shooter is known to be a law officer, and we do know the details, and those details certainly appear to implicate that officer, as with the case with Casey Goodson, so many more, the lack of confidence turns to distrust, and that leads to a feeling of desperation and despair, a natural tonic for which is anger. And we keep returning to this place again and again and again, and nothing seems to change. The mayor decries a tragedy and proclaims that reforms are needed. The city council debates policy changes, and a few may even be passed, but they're rarely enacted because the police union or the Republican-dominated legislature or gun lobbies, etc., intervene and do their best to make sure that new policies are not enacted or enforced or funded. Here are a couple of news reports on the case, just in case you missed them.
Some community members are questioning the process of the Franklin County prosecutor. They gathered outside his office today to call attention to the specific case of Craig Butler. He was charged with the murder of 13-year-old Sinze Reed 2 weeks ago, and his case has since been dismissed by the municipal court. NBC4's Anna Hoffman has been digging into this situation, and she joins us now live. So, Anna, how often does this typically happen?
Jared, a felony case being dismissed by the municipal court is typical protocol for the county prosecutor. The next step is normally indictment, and then the case will be picked up by the Common Pleas Court. But right now, there's no word on when and if that will happen. Family and friends of 13-year-old Sinze Reed gathered outside the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office to demand answers.
I will not stop until I'm heard, because Sinze Reed deserves justice.
Reed was shot and killed on October 12th at the Wedgewood Village Apartments. The next day, 36-year-old Krieg Butler Sr. was arrested and charged with Reed's murder. Witnesses say they saw Butler exit his truck before the shooting, then get back in and drive away after. Butler appeared in court later that week where he was arraigned on those murder charges, and he claimed it was self-defense. Court records show on October 20th, the case was dropped by the municipal court out of a request of the prosecutor. Butler has since been released, his bond dismissed, and he is now technically walking free.
This man left the scene and had to get caught by SWAT 2 days later. And then y'all let him out.
It's been 1 week since the case was dropped, and there are no signs of it being picked up by the Common Pleas Court. We reached out to the county prosecutor, Gary Tyak's office, for clarification on this issue. They sent us back a statement which says, in part, the municipal court does not have jurisdiction to hear felony cases except for a limited period of time. It is standard practice for almost every felony case filed in municipal court to be dismissed. This particular case is still under review for possible presentation to the grand jury, and unfortunately, I cannot advise you when the case will be presented to the grand jury.
The Opaque News. Hello, and welcome to my channel. And for those of you who are returning, welcome back. This article comes by way of Yahoo News. What we know about the killing of 13-year-old Sensei Reed. In the past few days, Columbus community members and online activists have been raising concerns about the handling of a homicide of a 13-year-old boy, questioning the actions of Columbus police and the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office. Sensei Reed, 13, was shot and killed October 12th at the Wedgewood Apartments in the Hilltop. Craig Butler, 36, was arrested within 48 hours of Reed's death and charged with murder. However, those charges were dismissed a few days later and have not been refiled. Online postings from local and national activists increased the spotlight on the case in recent days, with some making claims about Butler's alleged affiliation with hate groups, calling for federal investigation of the case and asking questions about the investigation more than 2 months after Reed's death. Here's what we know about the case and the ongoing investigation. Who was Sensei Reed? Columbus police were called about 5:45 p.m. October 12th to the Wedgewood Apartments complex in Hilltop on a report of a shooting. According to court records, an eyewitness saw Butler exit a red truck and fired multiple times at Reed. Butler then entered his vehicle and fled the scene, according to court records. Officers responding to a report of a shooting found Reed with gunshot injuries and provided medical aid until paramedics arrived. Reed was rushed in life-threatening condition to Ohio Health Doctors Hospital, where he died at 6:26 p.m. In his obituary, family members remembered Reed, who went by Zay, as a boy who loved music, video games, and spending time with his friends. Reed attended KIPP Columbus, a charter school on the north side. Another resident of Wedgewood Apartments, Craig A. Butler, 36, was initially charged with Reed's homicide and held on $1 million bond, but charges later were dropped pending the investigation. Why were charges dismissed against Craig Butler? Prosecutors filed a motion to dismiss the case in Franklin County Municipal Court after Butler's arrest. At the time, prosecutors said Butler was alleging that he had fired shots at Reed in self-defense. Because the autopsy report had not been completed, there was no forensic evidence about the positioning of Reed's wounds to prove or disprove Butler's claims. There is no statute of limitations for filing a murder charge, and charges could be refiled at a later date. The Franklin County Prosecutor's Office said Thursday it has no additional comment on the case at this time because it's an ongoing case. How did Sensei Reed die? Information surrounding Reed's injuries has been posted online. However, the official autopsy report from the Franklin County Coroner's Office has not yet been released. The Coroner's Office says reports take an average of 6 months to complete. The dispatch has filed a request to review the report when it becomes available. Until the autopsy report is completed, it is not known how many times Reed was shot and where on his body. Why wasn't Butler charged for illegally having a firearm? Butler has a prior conviction from 2019 for misdemeanor domestic violence in Franklin County Municipal Court. Federal law bars people with domestic violence convictions from carrying firearms, putting them under what is commonly called disability. Ohio law does not have a prohibition against people with misdemeanor convictions for domestic violence from carrying firearms. Ohio law prohibits convicted felons from having firearms in their possessions. Because Butler's conviction would bar him from having a gun only under federal law, Franklin County prosecutors cannot file that charge against him. No charges have been filed in federal court as of Thursday afternoon. What are community leaders and activists saying? On Thursday, U.S. Rep. Joyce Beatty D. Columbus tweeted about Reed's killing, saying that we must protect our children, followed by a hashtag calling for justice in the case.
The conflict in Ukraine shows no signs of de-escalating as both Russia and Ukraine have traded missile strikes, inflicting heavy tolls. As Republicans prepare to take control of the House of Representatives, as soon as they manage to elect a new Speaker of the House that is acceptable to the far-right MAGA faction that seems to be holding disproportionate power, they may seek to alter the U.S. policy in Ukraine. But for the moment, the Biden administration seems intent on sending more and bigger and newer weapons to Ukraine in its unrelenting push to not quite win that war and to avoid all other approaches to resolving the conflict. I found this podcast report that describes the recent escalations and their implications.
Three different Russian military airfields were attacked deep inside their country by what were almost certainly ancient Soviet-era Ukrainian drones. In this video, I'll explain why this attack is part of a recent pattern of escalating tit-for-tat attacks that may be leading us straight towards nuclear war. We'll also analyze how Ukraine managed to pull this tricky maneuver off, whether the United States can still hope to control the war, and what Putin's response has been. On Monday, December 5th, at 6 a.m., an explosion occurred at the Russian airbase Engels 2. Engels is in the Saratov region in the western part of Russia, 300 miles from the Ukrainian border. This attack is twice as deep into Russian territory as Ukraine has ever dared to strike before. It's home to the 22nd Heavy Bomber Aviation Division, which includes a squadron of the Tu-95 Bear H strategic bombers and the supersonic Tu-160 Blackjack bombers. Engels Air Base is arguably the most important one in all of Russia because it's the point of origin for the attacks launched on Ukraine's energy infrastructure over the past month. So these are precisely the same aircraft that Putin used to fire 100 Kh-55 and Kh-101 air-to-ground missile strikes on power plants, effectively knocking out nearly 40% of the country's power and sending millions of its citizens into the cold dark. Ukrainian air defense systems claim to have shot down 60 of these. This is Ukraine's retaliation for that. Russian media outlets admitted a Tu-95 bomber was damaged in the drone attack and two people were injured. Open source satellite images show before and after damage of the airfield. We can see what looks like fire extinguisher smoke underneath one of the aircraft, but little overall damage to the airfield itself. The Tu-95 costs $26 million a pop. It's a giant 152-foot-long aircraft, similar to the American B-52 bomber. I think the base was completely caught off guard with this surprise attack. Russia, and the world for that matter, believed Ukraine didn't have the capability to strike that far away because the ground-launched missiles like the M-31 HIMARS provided by the United States have a max range of only 40 miles, and more importantly, they thought Ukrainian President Zelensky wouldn't risk the consequence of such an escalation. We keep hearing this is an escalation, but what does that really mean? Isn't this just more of both sides attacking each other? This is a new type of target and location that was previously unofficially off limits. There are unspoken rules in war, and what we're witnessing right now in real time, is both sides slowly and incrementally violating those unwritten rules. This is part of a military phenomenon known as mission creep. Not the creepy guy Carl in your platoon, mission creep is defined as the incremental expansion of a mission beyond its original scope and ratchet effect spawned by initial success. I'm not saying if Ukraine is justified or not by increasing their scope of targets to new attacks. I'm saying that this is part of a clear pattern of escalation on both sides, and the United States is playing a role in this mission creepiness by providing increasingly powerful weapon systems to Ukraine. Which brings up the obvious question, what are we escalating towards? Well, a few days directly after the Ukrainian strike on these air bases, on December 9th, there was breaking news that Russia's President Vladimir Putin said he was considering updating their strategy to include a preemptive nuclear strike. You see, in the Soviet Union's final years, they adopted what was called a no first use policy in 1982. Since then, Russia's nuclear doctrine has flip-flopped a couple of times, but until these recent statements, it was understood that Putin would only use nuclear weapons in response to an atomic attack, or if there was an existential threat against the entire country's existence. The United States government has been playing it cool, claiming that they weren't involved in planning of this attack deep within Russia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken gave a statement in response to the attack, trying to distance ourselves, saying,
"We have neither encouraged nor enabled the Ukrainians to strike inside of Russia."
So this raises questions about the United States' ability to control what the Ukrainian military does. This statement by the Secretary of State makes it seem like we have little control of this situation that we're actively funding. More evidence that we don't have a handle on the situation comes from the Pentagon's own spokesperson, Sabrina Tsang, who said, quote,
"They are making the decisions on the ground in terms of targeting, in terms of when they conduct an operation. So, no, we were not necessarily informed or aware of any strike happening within Russia."
Oh, so we really aren't looped in at all. Considering the amount of money, equipment, and intelligence the United States is sending to Ukraine, I know this is a crazy suggestion, but maybe we should be aware of the new kinds of strikes happening there. I don't know. Especially ones deep in Russian territory that could represent an escalation between Russia and the US. All I'm saying is maybe there should be some strings attached to our aid. We appear to be taking a position of plausible deniability here. And if we keep playing dumb like this, then we shouldn't be surprised if something really dumb ends up happening here. And keeping track of all these new weapon systems now requires active duty military personnel to be inside of Ukraine, so you can see how a kind of tit-for-tat game can slowly lead to boots on the ground over a long enough period of time. The second target hit on Monday by the Ukrainian drone strikes shows us a side of the war no one has really considered recently, and sends a scary signal to Russian citizens. It was the Daglyov Air Base, located in Razian, less than 150 miles southeast of the Russian capital in Moscow. This shows us that Ukraine could hypothetically send an attack drone to hit a building inside Moscow, but they purposely have not done so yet because of the kind of retaliation an attack like that might bring. Just because you can do something in war doesn't mean it's necessarily a smart move. And Daglyov is home to the 203rd Independent Tanker Aviation Regiment, which primarily supports Russia's long-range bomber missions, making it incredibly important to their bomber missions' logistics and infrastructure. According to reports, the drone strike hit a fuel truck that exploded and damaged nearby aircraft. The Russian Ministry of Defense reported that 3 were KIA and 5 wounded in the attack. Satellite images from NASA's FIRM fire alert system of the area indicated strongly that at least one of the Tu-22M bombers at the airbase were damaged. The third strike happened to the Kalino airbase in Russia's Kursk region, 60 miles from the Ukrainian border, blowing up a fuel storage depot there. Now, there are many ways to calculate escalation and mission creepiness in war. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is obviously one good place to start, and from there we can see that it's been ratcheted up every month. Zelensky's attack on the Kerch Bridge in Crimea, Russia's mobilization of 300,000 citizens, Putin's attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, which was previously off limits. Then the mission creepiness starts to spill outside of Ukraine, with an attack on the Nord Stream pipeline of unknown origin. Now add to it Putin's increasingly threatening rhetoric about his potential use of nuclear weapons. But it would be stupid to write his statements off as just threats. I think what he's really doing is starting to articulate where exactly that red line is for him. He's just starting to explain exactly where he'll push the button. I think if Ukraine continues to recapture territory and strikes new targets inside of Russia, then we can expect Putin to make more of these kinds of clarifying statements where he's going to narrow down and clarify the point at which he claims he will push the button. I think it's important to point out that Ukraine didn't actually take responsibility for this attack, so we don't know who did it, but presidential advisor Mikhail Podolyak tweeted a hint that same day with a metaphor that doesn't really work in English, but basically what he's saying to Russia is that what you put out into the world is what will come back at you. He's basically saying this is karma and you get what you ask for. Russian military veterans who are blogging from the front lines and have tremendous influence in Russia, they posted suggesting that these attacks were done by Ukrainian special forces deep within Russian territory that are still active there, and that there's no way that these Ukrainian drones were able to travel 300 miles and evade anti-air systems. So the question of how dire their anti-air defense systems are is still up in the air. The fact that Ukraine pulled off this attack deep within Russian territory without US help is clear because Zelensky has previously specifically requested long-range attack drones from the United States, but he was denied. The US Air Force had a plan, in fact, to send Ukraine their old Reaper and Grey Eagle drones, but this was also turned down precisely because the United States did not want Ukraine striking in Russia and escalating the war. Before we jump into how Ukraine pulled this attack off exactly, let's look at their drone strategy up until now. I spoke directly with Serbian sniper named Dijon, who fought on the Russian side as a regular soldier against Ukraine in the Battle of Kiev early in the war.
Can you elaborate a little bit about how drone warfare has changed war?
In the very beginning, we used to do a recon by old-fashioned foot. So we went into, let's say, a woods, try to investigate, is there any enemy soldier? But right now, we do not do that anymore. Right now, we are using drones and even a small Mavic 3, DJI quadcopter, is much better option to use for the recon missions. And I have to admit that Ukrainians are pretty skillful in using those drones. They have much more than we have.
Types of reconnaissance and attack drones used that we are talking about here often don't have any of that annoying arms deal oversight. They can be bought directly online through a Chinese website or wherever you like. Arms dealing has really changed since the simple days of Viktor Bout. But was this really the first time Ukraine has attacked a target deep inside of Russia? Very early on in the war, Ukraine targeted the Miliarov Air Base less than 20 miles from their border, with what was believed to be a short-range ballistic missile at the time. If you're under the impression that I mispronounced that Russian city, why do you think I go by Chris Cappy? It's because I can't pronounce my own Italian last name. Capoluto? Capolu? I don't know. You may remember that early on in the war, Ukraine found success using the famous Turkish Bayraktar TB2 drones to keep Russian forces at bay and to attack deep behind their supply lines. Whatever happened to those things since then? Well, apparently those drones are no longer being used by Ukrainian forces since August. This could be for a few reasons, right? It could be because Russian forces are getting better at using early warning radars to locate drones. It could be because they have better electronic warfare weapons that are now being deployed to jam and interfere with these transmissions. And Russian media has speculated that Putin may have forbid Turkey from selling more of the TB2 Bayraktar drones to Ukraine as part of their gas deal that they negotiated. We know the accuracy of Ukrainian artillery is greatly increased by coordination with drones.
Have you noticed Ukrainian training skills change since 2014?
In regards to artillery, I can say that there is a huge quantum leap, we can say. They are at least 10,000 times more precise than they were in 2014. You cannot compare those two armies in that regard. They become much more precise, and they are utilizing artillery in excellent manner.
So this kind of attack has been commonplace throughout the war, but it's always been limited close to their border. So there are people likely in the comment section now who will claim that this isn't mission creepiness. There's no mission creep going on here because Ukraine's goals have not changed and their mission hasn't expanded since the start of the war. They want a complete withdrawal of Russian forces from their country.
And there's a really good argument to be made there, and I agree with it.
But I think attacking deep within Russia is an escalation. The Russian Ministry of Defense claims that Ukraine used Soviet-made surveillance drones that are old from the 1970s, specifically the Tu-141, to attack both the Engels and the Deripaska Air Base. This sounds outrageous, because there's no way that old 1979 technology would be accurate enough to be flown directly into a target as small as an enemy plane 300 miles away. If this is really how Ukraine accomplished it, then they would have had to have modified the Tu-141 into a low-flying cruise missile of sorts. The Tu-141, by the book, has a range of 600 miles, it weighs 13,700 pounds, and flies at 600 miles per hour. It would have required upgrades in order for it to be capable of hitting a target that's essentially a 10-meter circular error of probability. Watching the YouTube channel Backyard Science makes me think that some clever engineers could possibly modify the Tu-141 to do that. The other evidence is that in March, a mysterious Tu-141 drone armed with a bomb flew into and crashed in Croatia's capital, confusing everyone at the time. No one knew for sure what the hell was going on back then, but in hindsight, it was likely an early failed test of the Soviet-era drone's ability to kamikaze attack. However, it's also possible that the drones used in these long-range attacks were brand new technology, right? The Russian Ministry of Defense would have every reason to downplay the sophistication and capabilities of the Ukrainian military. There is some evidence to support this theory, with Ukraine's state-of-the-art weapons producer, Yubalkran, announcing that they've been developing a new strike drone with the words Asvedom written on its side, meaning I will repay, poetic. On Facebook, November 24th, they posted photos of this new drone. Could they turn this prototype UAV around and use it in less than a month, though? According to the November Post, the drone was still in its early testing phases, attempting to fix issues related to controlling it during weather and preventing electronic jamming. If Putin wants to have a credible nuclear threat, he will need these strategic bombers. At the Deglyev Air Base, they recently put up protective walls along the flight lines using old rubber tires, not the most sophisticated anti-air defense systems. So how much has this attack degraded Russia's ability? The Russian Air Force could be forced to disperse their long-range Tu-95 bombers to other locations, that's possible, but they have between 50 and 60 of them operational right now in their arsenal, although it could force them to have to reallocate air defense systems that are currently protecting their frontline troops in Ukraine. Or they would have to choose to leave their air bases vulnerable. As analyst Ruslan Leviev told the Washington Post, Russia and Ukraine have a finite number of these, and Russia already removed some of these systems from Syria to put on the front lines in Ukraine earlier this year, showing how short-handed they are with their air defense abilities. These strikes might not have caused a ton of damage, but they provide the kind of morale boosts that are vital for Ukraine as the war stretches into the winter, and talk about how Ukraine should settle and how they should negotiate is going to start to ramp up. There are convincing arguments on both sides about whether or not it's in Ukraine's interest to come back to the negotiating table with Russia at this point, and we can take a deeper look at that in another video if you're interested. To be fair, this war has not been a straight line of escalation. There have been some pressure valve releases, right? Turkey helped mediate a deal between Ukraine and Russia to allow shipment of grain to Africa. United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia helped mediate a deal between the United States and Russia for a prisoner exchange where we got back WNBA player Brittany Griner in exchange for Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout. When I was in Iraq, they were starting to release busloads of prisoners that they'd caught early in the war, while at the same time we were capturing other insurgents. So I know how difficult it is to see someone get released that you think should still be behind bars. Talking about Viktor Bout here, not Brittany Griner. This is obviously not necessarily a fair trade, but this shows that there are some diplomatic lines open to help release these escalation pressure valves. But it looks like it's going to be a long, horrible winter in Ukraine and now possibly Russia as well. If you're interested in getting into military open source intelligence and you want to see all of the sources and tools that I use to put these videos together, follow me on Instagram. I'm going to post a link there to a spreadsheet with all of the intelligence reports. Thank you for watching Spare Parts Army. Check out this video on how Lockheed Martin and the military industrial complex in the United States got too big to fail.
Lastly, Israel is now under one of the farthest right administrations in its recent history, with a new Netanyahu coalition stating outright its intentions to step up the construction of illegal annexations or settlements in the occupied West Bank. The response, as always, from the United States has been to express deep, but ostensibly meaningless, concern, and to propose no policy changes whatsoever. Here's a report from Al Jazeera that attempts to offer a rounded perspective.
Benjamin Netanyahu is back to power in Israel. Some may have a sense of deja vu, but this time he'll lead the most hardline government to date. So, what are the intentions of this new government? And what does it mean for the so-called peace process with the Palestinians? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. After 2 months of political wrangling, Israel's most right-wing and religiously conservative government in the country's history has been sworn in. The coalition is being led by Benjamin Netanyahu, who returns as prime minister for a sixth term. His appointment comes 18 months after he was ousted from power and while he's facing corruption charges. Netanyahu says national security will continue to be his top priority. He says he also wants to normalize relations with more Arab countries and expand illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Most of the important ministerial posts have been filled by conservative-leaning or ultra-Orthodox politicians.
We have four main goals, which I defined in my speech. I will repeat them because they are important. First of all, stop Iran. This is an existential question. First of all, we care about existence and security. Second, to restore security and governance within the state of Israel. Third thing, take care of the cost of living and the housing crisis. The fourth thing, and I believe it is also within reach, is to dramatically expand the circle of peace.
Last year, we saw a lot of mistakes from the outgoing government, and today we come back with a lot of energy to change the reality for good in Israel.
Let's take a look at Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the ideology of his new government. The 73-year-old leader joined the Likud party in 1988. His first role in government was as deputy foreign minister. In 1993, he was elected party leader. During the 90s, he started Israel on a path towards a free market economy. His government worked with Palestinians on security. He later conditionally agreed to a two-state solution. The new Israeli coalition is deeply conservative. Its members come from ultra-nationalist and ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our three guests from West Jerusalem. Flor Hassan Nahum, she is the deputy mayor of Jerusalem and a member of the Likud party. From Rehovot, Ofer Kasif, he's an Israeli politician and member of the Hadash movement. And from Ramallah, Mustafa Barghouti, he's the Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative and former Palestinian Information Minister. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks for joining us today on Inside Story. Flor, let me start with you today. From your perspective, what are the intentions of this new government, and are you at all concerned about the fact that this is the most far-right, religiously conservative government in Israel's history?
So, good afternoon. First of all, I want to say that I'm not concerned at all. I'm glad that we have the government, Likud-led government. And I think in the last year, with the divisions that we've seen in the government that was here earlier, they couldn't make one single decision because of the very, very contradicting views that the different members of that same government has. It's good that we finally have a stable government here in Israel. And I believe that there will be two major policy drives in this government, and that will be dealing with the threat from Iran, a threat that gets bigger every day as they continue to slaughter their own people. And the second is the continuation and the development and the growth of the Abraham Accords.
Mustafa Barghouti, most of the important ministerial posts have been filled by conservative-leaning or ultra-Orthodox politicians. What does all of this mean for the so-called peace process with the Palestinians?
This is the death of the peace process. Netanyahu has made sure to kill it previously in previous governments. And this new government is the most racist, the most extreme, the most right-wing, the most fundamentalist, and not only the worst government in the history of this region, but also it includes fascists like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Those people have been accused of terrorism before, even in Israeli courts. And the movement they used to belong to, Kahana movement, was classified as a terrorist movement in the United States and in Israel. This man, who was Ben-Gvir, who was not allowed to serve in the Israeli army when he was 18 years old because of his extremism, is now the security minister of this government. This government declares openly and bluntly that its main goal is to annex the West Bank and to expand settlements at a rate that is that never happened before. What does that mean? That means the killing of the possibility of the so-called two-state solution, preventing Palestinians from the right of becoming free from occupation, and preventing them from having a state of their own, and also consolidating a system of racism based on what this government declared, that the land of historic Palestine, what they call Eretz Israel, is exclusive only for Jewish people. That means they are consolidating a system of apartheid. The picture is very clear.
Ofer, I saw you reacting to some of what Mustafa Barghouti was saying there. I've heard you say before today that it's your view that Israel is heading in a very dangerous direction. Where do you see things going from here, and just how concerned are you?
First of all, I'm very concerned, even anxious, and I will be even sharper than my friend Mustafa Barghouti. This government is pursuing by legislation, by changing the public discourse. This government actually carries out a coup d'etat. It is changing the regime, not only the government. It is going to be a full-fledged fascist regime with neo-Nazi components, and I want to emphasize that. The so-called party, the so-called religious Zionism party, consists not only of, as I said, full-fledged fascists, but also of neo-Nazis. Ben-Gvir is a neo-Nazi thug. They have not only, you know, they don't only support the ongoing malicious, murderous occupation and apartheid that Israel has been carrying on for ages now, but also supports a racial theory, Jewish supremacy, Jewish supremacism. This is what the government, this is the character of this government. This is a very dangerous situation, which I hope we continue our struggle, of course, in Chadash, in the parliament, and in the streets against this fascist government, against this coup d'etat, against the occupation, and against their plans to exile and to carry ethnic cleansing of the indigenous Palestinian people. We will not let them do that, but we do need the international community on our side. We will not succeed stopping those crimes if the international community doesn't stand with us.
Fleur, you heard Ofer Kassif there calling this a coup d'etat. He said that this was a full-fledged fascist regime. And I saw you reacting to that. You looked like you wanted to jump in, so go ahead.
Well, I don't understand. Mr. Kassif doesn't understand what democracy looks like. He's calling for a coup d'etat because this is really how the Israeli public voted. And what we have to do is analyze why the Israeli public voted the way that they did, because a year ago they voted for a very different government, and this is the system that we're living in. And the main reason that people got fed up of many things that Mr. Kassif wants to ignore and pretend that don't exist, and a Palestinian Authority friend also wants to ignore and pretend it doesn't exist. Let's start with the Palestinian Authority representative. If this is such a horrible fascist government, then why didn't the Palestinian Authority make peace when they could have? with the Rabin government, with the Ehud Barak's government, with the Ehud Olmert government. There were governments that looked very, very different, and still the rejection...
Because your governments wanted to keep occupation.
Excuse me, I let you finish. The rejection of the Palestinian Authority is the reason we don't have peace. Because ultimately the Palestinian authority
and what
the
about
Palestinian
annexing
leadership
why
cannot
you want to
all right.
accept
Mustafa Barghouti,
the existence
I'll...
of it. I think that I deserve to finish my point
I'm just saying,
without interruption.
Floor, I'm just saying, I'm going, Floor, I'm just saying, Floor, I'm just saying that I'm going
to
let you finish your point.
My point without interruptions. I think I deserve to finish my point without interruption. The Palestinian Authority, the reason we don't have peace today, and this is what everybody keeps forgetting or ignoring or sweeping under the carpet, is because the Palestinian leadership still not accepted emotionally the existence of a Jewish state. This is not about not having a Palestinian state. This is about accepting that we're not going anywhere. And so the Rabin government, which was a left-wing government, that wasn't good enough. And the Ehud Olmert's government, which was more of a right-wing government and still gave them 97% of what they said that they wanted, still wasn't good enough. And Ehud Barak's government before the Olmert government, which was a left-wing government, still wasn't good enough. So what do you want the Israeli public to do when you've made it clear that it doesn't matter what government we had, you're not ready to sit down and talk about this?
And Floor, all right.
It's just
you are lying.
Floor,
you are
I need
lying.
To go. Please, everybody, I'm going to let Mustafa Barghouti reply now. Okay. Before I did that, Floor, I was trying to say before that I was going to let you finish your point and then give the floor to Mustafa Barghouti if you had allowed me to finish what I was saying.
I
now,
Mustafa,
now Mustafa, Mustafa Barghouti, please go ahead.
Well, your guest is just telling lies. And of course, this is the usual narrative, the rubbish narrative that the Likud party keeps spreading. Anybody who wants to know reality, all they need is to read the program of this new Israeli government. Palestinians never hid away from peace. It was the Israeli governments who continuously wanted to keep occupation of East Jerusalem, wanted to keep occupation of Jordan Valley, did not want Palestinians to have real sovereignty, and that's why we don't have peace. It was Netanyahu, the leader of the party of this of your guest, who blocked all peace talks since 1996. To know their program, you can just look at what they say. They say they want to annex the West Bank. How can you have peace if you want to annex the Palestinian territory of the West Bank? How can we have peace if the whole land of what they call Eretz Israel, which is Palestine, is exclusive for Jewish people only? How can we have peace when you have fascists like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in charge, not only of security, but of settlement activities, and when they are calling for ethnic cleansing of Palestinians? Why we don't have peace? Because Israel and the Israeli groups have conducted the worst act of ethnic cleansing in 1948, which your guest would deny. When more than 70% of Palestinians were displaced from their homeland, why they are not allowing these refugees to come back to their homeland? Why did they destroy 530 Palestinian villages? Why are they preventing us from being free from their occupation? She speaks about Iran. The issue here is not Iran. The issue here is their occupation of Palestinian land. The issue here is that they have established a system of apartheid and racial discrimination, and that should be a cause and reason for establishing sanctions and boycott of this Israeli government, which, as I said, the most racist, the most extreme, includes fascists in it, and it is going to build the road towards an explosion, not only here, but in the whole region.
Ofer, I saw you wanted to jump in before. I do want to ask you, though, you mentioned in your last answer that you were hoping to get the international community on your side. What does that look like? What must the international community do from your point of view? But also, I want to ask you about the fact that there are many who are concerned right now that Israel's global standing might be damaged by this new government. Do you expect that it will?
I expect to the extent that I hope that it will. Because that's what part of the solution. I have to say a few words regarding the former speaker, the things that the former speaker said, if I may. On top of the lies that the primary speaker, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, said, we have to emphasize, I agree with and endorse what every word that Mustafa Barghouti said. But I would like to add one thing is that this government and most of the parts of this government don't care about security or no security. They don't care if the Palestinians are free or the Palestinians posing any kind of a threat to the Israeli people, which they are not. They only care about what they conceive, their fundamentalist fascist perception that God, as it were, promised the land to the Jewish people. And because of that, they are entitled to control the whole land by deporting or ethnic cleansing the indigenous Palestinians or even kill them. And this is exactly explicitly what Smotrich and Ben-Gvir have been saying for so many years. They think that Israel, as a Jewish state, should control the whole land and make the Palestinians slaves. And if they don't accept their lot, they should be killed or exiled. Because God, as it were, promised the land to the Jewish people. That's the point. It has nothing to do with security. The main threat to the region, to the world, and of course to the Palestinians and the Israeli is not Iran, which I do not sympathize, by the way. It is the Israeli government itself. And if Israel is so interested in democracy, in rights, so why, in addition to the occupation, in addition to other crimes it's been carrying out, why now under this government, this specific government, already declared that it's going to revoke law that bars racist blocs in parliament? What does it have to do with the threat, as it were, that the Palestinian posed to Israel? And why do they want to enact a discrimination or to amend the discrimination law so it will allow businesses and doctors to refuse service people like Arabs or disabled or LGBT? Why do they support gender segregation? Why do they support the superseding clause that will abolish the High Court and eliminate the independent judicial system? Because this is a fascist government with neo-Nazi components.
I'm sorry.
And the international community, if I just finish one sentence with your permission, international community must understand that it should stop this madness. Because if the international community does not stop this madness, does not lead to the elimination of the occupation, to the liberation of the Palestinian people, eventually, not only the Palestinians and the Israelis in the Middle East are going to pay the price, but the whole world. We are sitting on a volcano that's going to explode, and the blame will be the international community's one as well.
Ofer, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are starting to run out of time. Fleur, I see that you want to jump in, so I'm going to go ahead and let you. Go ahead.
I just find it extremely sad how Mr. Katsif, who obviously does not believe in a Jewish state for the Jewish people, side by side with the Palestinian state, he obviously that's not what he believes in. And of course, neither does the Palestinian Authority representative. We're not talking about 67. We're not talking about occupied lands. We're talking about the very existence of Israel that these two other panelists do not even accept. So this seems like a bit of an empty, this seems like a bit of an empty debate, because if they don't accept that Jewish people deserve their own homeland in our ancestral homeland, then this really,
not
this debate really seems pretty empty.
Not if it's right.
And in fact, Mr. Katsif should not even be allowed to be a member of Knesset if he doesn't believe in a Jewish and democratic state. Which
now
obviously
you can see
he doesn't. But ultimately,
now you can
I think that even sadder thing, if you let me finish my point,
state.
The even
apartheid
sadder thing,
regime,
the even sadder thing is how...
Government.
If you just let Fleur,
finish
her point, go ahead.
He spoke at length and nobody interrupted him.
Go ahead.
But what I think that is the saddest thing about the whole thing, and this is why the Abraham Accords is so important, is because for 75 years, the Palestinian leadership has not taken responsibility for one thing or for anything. Everything is always the blame of Israel. We fight defensive wars that we did not start. Somehow it's our fault. We leave the Gaza Strip and we leave the land to the Palestinians. We get rockets and somehow that's our fault. And this infantilization of the Palestinian people taking all responsibility from their shoulders is actually the real racism here. Thank you very much.
Mustafa Barghouti, you in the past have said that all Palestinian forces should join together in a bid to boycott and isolate this new Israeli leadership. Is that going to happen? What are you hearing from various Palestinian political groups and factions?
Yes, of course. I think now the formation of this new Israeli government, which is a very dangerous one, not only for Palestinians, but also for Israelis themselves, should be a factor that pushes Palestinians immediately towards unity. And I hope this will be achieved very soon, especially that now it is very clear that this new Israeli government has no intention at all of getting any close to anything that is called peace. But let me explain here. I think your guest is really self-deceiving. She's deceiving herself and trying to deceive the whole audience. She claims that Palestinians are responsible, but she would not be able to deny the fact that Israel is the one that is occupying Palestinians. She cannot deny the fact that Israel is the one that conducted ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. She cannot deny the fact that Israel is the one that has established, according not to me, but according to Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, President Jimmy Carter, and even the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem itself, Israel has created the worst system of apartheid ever in human history. The longest occupation in modern history and the worst system of apartheid and oppression and racism and discrimination against Palestinians. So she cannot claim that others are racist when she is defending the most racist system in this region and probably in the world. On the other hand, let me tell you something very clear. I do believe that when your guest says that Mr. Kassif cannot be a member of the Knesset, she actually reflects exactly the kind of fascist thinking that this government in Israel has. They want even to exclude people from having the right to democratic participation and democratic competition. Don't interrupt me, please. For them, the Palestinians are all terrorists. Anybody that supports Palestinians is accused of anti-Semitism. If it's a good Jewish person who is voting for human rights and for respecting other people like Palestinians, they call him a self-hating Jew. This is the kind of racism that is even reflecting on Israeli people. And it's a very dangerous government. And I do share with Mr. Kassif the hope that the world would realize how dangerous this government is for Palestinians, Israelis, and the whole region, and impose sanctions and boycott on these fascists.
Ofer, we just have about a minute.
Maybe the world will wake up and realize the corruption of the Palestinian Authority government.
Laura, I'm sorry, but we're just about to run out of time. I just have a question for Ofer now. Ofer, we just have about a minute left. From your perspective, can this government actually last? Is this coalition strong or is it fragile?
We'll do the best we can in the parliament and in the streets to stop this government and to change it. I surely hope that the government will not last for more than a few months. It may be a wishful thinking, but we'll do our best to realize this wishful thinking. But as I said in the beginning, we do need the international community. It is impossible, it's unacceptable that so many states around the globe, especially the United States, support Israel blindly, even when it commits crimes against humanity. So I surely hope that the international community will wake up very soon and stop this madness. Because if it doesn't, as I said before, everybody's going to pay the price. First and foremost, Palestinians, but also Israelis, the whole region, and eventually the whole world. So it is not only a moral decree, but also the interest of the people of the world. They should stand with us and join forces against everybody who supports one or another kind of supremacism, Jewish supremacism, Arab supremacism, or whatever. And unfortunately, the speaker that I again cannot recall her name, she's one of the supporters of Jewish supremacism. I, with Mustafa Barghouti, which I'm proud to call my friend.
Ofer, I'm sorry. To interrupt you, but we have run out of time. I apologize. We want to thank all of our guests. The discussion must come to an end right now. Thanks to all of our guests, Flor Hassan Nahum, Ofer Kassif, and Mustafa Barghouti. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.
That was a report from Al Jazeera on the new government in Israel and its potential implications. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.